You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Sound Poetry. I'm your host, David Gilmore, on Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 LPFM. And today we have the pleasure of hearing a poet who has won many awards. One especially, I think, that was exceptional in his career. Ryla Dustin is with us. Well, we go on now. We're going to have quite a venture with A Night in London in your courtship experience on in a distant land, and not an exotic place necessarily, but it can be one that's thought of as exotic if you're from Whatcom County.
Definitely, yeah, and it was definitely exotic to me. Okay, so yeah, this is, you know, I guess maybe beginning, you know, that dive into this kind of unknown world, traveling the world a bit. So this is called Last Night in London. Apart from her body, I remember the birds. How we'd wake at the same time, as night came down among the purple trees. Her body, my body, and the birds, all waking at one moment. She, in silence, rising to sit by the mirror and the portrait she would not show me. While she painted, I walked in the park past graffiti that said, "Call your mother," and nodding policemen with red noses, asking myself why I would hope for a home in someone slowly falling out of love with me, while chatty British women left the mall with bags brushing their thighs, a sound like breath. I learned a secret before I left. The birds never flew off but fell silent when someone was near. The color of dust, they just disappeared until deep in my quiet, if no one passed, the whole tree would speak to itself again.
Yes.
Kind of an odd one, perhaps.
It tells a lot about the relationship in some respects. She's a painter. The portrait she would not show me. Perhaps your portrait, who knows? Or a portrait of someone, but she didn't want you to behold it.
Right.
Interesting kind of withholding going on there.
Our conversation has reminded me of is challenge with narrative poetry. I find it very difficult to encapsulate a relationship in a poem. You know, whether it's, you know, a family member like in Light Years or First Star, Last Night in London, I would say was a shorter relationship. You know, it was really like, I don't know, maybe a few months or something in total. And so that it was a little bit less daunting to try to convey that relationship in a poem. But, you know, the challenge is it's like you have to really let go of the possibility of fitting everything in and even everything that's important. You know, I had tried, for example, with First Star, you know, this person that I dated in high school, like I had tried for years to write that poem, years and years. In the end, you know, it's like the geese play a pretty large role in the poem, for example, and I would never have thought of that as a particularly important detail. But I think, you know, there's some way in which if you kind of hit the right current in a poem, which I find like for me comes through music, you know, finding the repeating sounds that you can kind of hit on in a poem. You can sort of follow that and it will sometimes sort of, you know, like a sculptor working with the grain of wood or something. It will kind of lead you through certain details that will make a sketch that conveys things, you know, so you don't have to say, like you were saying in this last poem we had just read, or I had just read Last Night in London, it was like difficult to convey that withholding that, or that kind of distance, you know, and kind of, I mean, this person that I was staying with at the time and was sort of falling in love with, but things seemed kind of confusing. You know, she was a pretty private person, I think. So, you know, not having to come in and say like, well, you know, these are the ways in which it seemed like she was quite actually kind of evasive, or maybe felt like she was being put out by having me there. And I begin to pick up on that. And, you know, instead you have these details like not showing the portrait, or even like the tree kind of going silent in one's presence, unless, you know, and then if it's kind of left to itself, or if you're very quiet, it will kind of hold, you know, start up thinking and living and speaking to itself again. So yeah, I think that's a real challenge with narrative poems, is how do you, you know, find that current that will guide you through things, and then let go of, you know, 98% of the important information that you feel compelled to share, and just kind of let it be this sketch instead.
You definitely also, poems play off one another. In one, you have migratory birds, and you give a mythological, pseudo-mythological explanation for that, which is quite witty in light of the relationship that you have. But here, these are birds that never fly off. They don't go.
Mm-hmm.
But you're the one who is asking yourself why you'd hope for a moment in someone falling out of love with me, to asking why I'd hope for home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this homing aspect again, but here the birds don't go, they're home. Yeah. And also, call your mother. The graffiti is ominous. In a way, it's giving you the warning.
It is. Yeah. And I mean, that's true. There, what I really did see that graffiti, and it was like, I loved it. It's so funny, you know. I just love that graffiti. But it does feel kind of ominous, you know. And when you're sort of a traveler, which I love traveling, you know, and us, but when you're traveling, and then you're also kind of like trying to make a romance work with someone, you're kind of, you know, it can be a precarious feeling space, because you're in their world and you want to be respectful of it and non-intrusive, but also it's like, it can feel very precarious. So yeah, I did end up, you know, leaving London, and yeah, so I wish this person well, you know, and we haven't really spoken in a long time. But again, you know, a teacher, I would say, to me, you know, if the experience was kind of difficult of trying to figure out what was going on and stuff, and was this person as interested in me as like it seemed like, and kind of navigating all of that, it was really valuable. And I think I learned a lot about myself because of her. Yeah, so I'm appreciative, but yeah. Right.
The moment of fields now. I like to hear this one. This is a longish poem of short pieces where each one perhaps taken as a vignette of sorts, but in the whole, it's the movement of fields.
Right, yeah, and I'll try to pause a little just to show where each section break is. We kind of move through these different sketches. As listeners will probably notice this, you know, I would consider this a love poem, but it's also kind of an ode to eyesight, I suppose. The movement of fields. At sunrise, I run my eyes along you and collect you as a pool fills with the image of a drowned bird. As the field outside this graying farm is in love with the shape of wind. Sight is the mind making sense of the world's raw hunks and filaments, sketched in guesswork of occipital lobes, fusiform gyrus drawing out the differences between one nose and another, one cheek into the stark relief of a friend's face, cortex showing where a ball isn't yet, but will be after the instant its image flickers up the optic nerve. We read about this, then walk to the dock, watching waves lacerated by light. One theorist thinks language came through sight, not sound. That learning to read the signs of our prey in the wilderness filled us with symbols. Hoof, hair, bent fern. Something can mean without being. Something can imply. Dark hair in your comb, the jade plant you watered before you left, a photo replicating your body, which holds the whole ocean inside. If it's true, the first signs we learned were left by fleeing things. Every mark, a mark of escape. Every print, the shape of what's gone. And so we call these words a passage. With language, movement, absence, loss became legible. The night we met was pink gin, your grin, limbs lifting in fake fog. Your blocky script is bird prints in snow. When you're gone, your body goes on in my memory, diving into dark surf, towing something silver away. It was easy for God to make blind life, and the first seeing thing was only a little harder. But the second seeing thing, to make something that could look into something, looking into it. Downtown glows at dusk, our hands clasp in my car. As we glide below lamps and lit billboards, you fall asleep, which is familiar to me, though I can't see where you go when I watch you.
Oh, yes. I see what you mean by ode to seeing. There is definitely a rumination on how the mind goes from whatever it's doing through our senses, and then how does it come out in the form of sound?
Mm-hmm.
How does it get there? But yes, there's a great deal about neurology, if you want, in this, to put it in a prosaic term, but
yeah,
it's not
indeed
necessarily a neurological poem. It is a true poem of verse that enchants. And it's very well done in those segments. I really liked some of the surprise coming with pink gin, your grin, limbs lifting in fake fog. The not only the alliteration, but the rhyming and things like that were really good there. Little spark of the old-fashioned music of poetry as you go on with a little philosophy about memory, diving into dark surf, as you did in the last poem that you read,
right,
towing something silver away, leaving it up to the listener, reader, what is that being towed away there?
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm glad that the music kind of felt resonant for you, because I think that's another challenge at times with a poem like this, not so much narrative, but the cool information that it seeks to convey. You know, just this poem partly was inspired by so many amazing things about how, you know, as it says, the mind like makes sense. You know, it's what we see is not just information that our eyes convey. It's processed by our brain based on all kinds of expectations. And you know, there's that thing that it's, I don't know how well the poem conveys it, but if someone throws a ball, you see the ball, but you actually, you know, where the ball is actually, you know, depending on how fast it's moving, it's actually like slightly not quite there. You're seeing it a little bit ahead of where it literally is, because the brain has evolved, the human brain has evolved to kind of process that, to account for the incredibly small amount of time it takes the visual signal to enter your brain and be processed. So you're kind of, you know, and I've heard that, you know, one of the important skills in early humans, I guess, or hominids, was the ability to like hit moving targets or catch things, and you know, that's an adaptation in the brain for changing the fact, you know, the way that we process the sight of a moving object. And so things like that are just so remarkable to me. And you know, the challenge is, can you do something that like a Wikipedia entry couldn't do, you know, because if all your poem is going to do is just share cool information, it's like, why not just give someone the link to, you know, the visual cortex or something and let them read
all. Right.
But yeah, music, I think, can be one way to do that, you know, and of course, like weaving in kind of the subjective and the personal and those elements. But definitely some amazing facts that inspired kind of this poem and, you know, that theory about language coming to us basically from tracking prey, you know, from seeing things that implied the presence of something that had passed through or was absent in that moment. You know, that's something I read. I think the theorist was named Carlo Ginzburg. And that's some, there's some notes about that in the back of this book. But yeah, just really amazing stuff. I feel so much wonder about how we are in the world, what we are.
Yes, the movement of fields. Fields is a word that we have many, many meanings. It's a metaphor for many things, right?
Mm-hmm.
The fields, the landscape of the mind. How does it move? What senses make it, and how does it make sense?
Mm-hmm.
There's all sorts of conundrums.
Mm-hmm.
Fields of vision. Yes, very, very interesting. In the bones. Now, I think that you are, you're hooked on bones, not fish bones necessarily, but you're hooked on bones that give signs of things that had been. Maybe you've got an archaeological affinity.
I love the scientific endeavor, you know, and I just love the awe, you know. It's kind of those ruins there, or these after traces.
In the bones, deep in the bones, here we go.
In the bones. The finback had beached a long time ago. Storm-scattered ribs, vertebrae polished by sand, knuckle bones caged in black grass. All winter, as we fell out of love in the old barn, I read the long story of whales. How they were land scavengers once, like hooved raccoons, hunger drove into the sea. While you dreamed beside me, and wind worked the eaves into a song. Mornings I walked past pines growing stunted in sandy soil, head cocked to hear the moaning made by the bones. The last thing they said, a vestigial hip clicking on stone. How the body wanders, writing its loss from home to home. How the bones hold hard to this history.
Migration comes to its end sometimes in the land-sunk whale, and the bones remind us of a history, a long, long history. Your concern for even including a relationship in that one too, how often we get this feeling, with some frequency of the terminality, the ephemerality of a relationship in something that goes back in time in the form of the early mammalian history, you know. We're mammals. We're as ephemeral as the whales, right? We haven't gone through all of our transformations yet, but maybe we'll have more that will surprise us, unimaginable ones.
Yeah.
And do you think there's going to be a change in Interstate 5 before we have seen the end of our lives?
Gosh, I hope so. And I think Interstate 5 is, that poem is another kind of plumbing the past, or kind of delving into history or the past more. And like a lot of these poems, you know, I would say that's kind of a key theme that you hit upon there, you know, whether it's noticing some bones and kind of what that suggests about ourselves. Or you know, trying to understand the history of what happened with, you know, something like a secret or something, you know, a disaster that's kind of etched in our lives in the Northwest here. So yeah, I would say Interstate 5 definitely, you know, we're plumbing the past again in this poem. We're kind of going deeper, maybe into a, I guess, a more personal past, I would say.
Right. This is sort of a road trip of sorts with a catalogue of all things slightly going wrong, indications of a straight Interstate 5, a very large freeway, but surrounding it are, again, the omens of things to come, of decay, and not so much the life that streams on it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And maybe even rebirth, you know, as well.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So Interstate 5. What remains of these lost deltas after the mills shut down? An art of disappearing. Black-windowed bars. The towers of a closed factory still blinking their red lights to hide. No works inside. For years, I drove past these roadside diners carved out of rain, trailer parks lined with European trees, the truck stop where cigarette smoke drifts into the air like a crease in an old photo. After Vietnam, my father worked in such a place, a gas station where he could hide from his own father, sleeping among beer cans in the owner's storage loft, wages and cheap rent in exchange for silent work, pumping fuel for tourists southbound to California sun. I go north instead, follow the seam of diminishing sky as firs crowd in to hem the highway. Low mist makes an iridescent sweat on asphalt, a ghost hint of gasoline as I pull off for the Exxon. Even now, I forget the Oregon law against pumping my own gas. I'm startled by the man who appears beside my truck. Young, buzzed hair already thinning. A vet, maybe, from more recent wars. He leans on my door, asks how much. Tattoos of flowers and a bullet, like a weird chrysalis, spill from his rolled-up sleeve.
I think your next book of poems ought to have e-vehicles in them, so that the gasoline and the explosions that come from fossil fuels are behind us.
Gosh, and I hope so.
Yet there are dangers in the battery too. We know that. So we're going, your Oregon life, was that where you were off the grid?
Yes, before I moved to Michigan. And so that would have been like 2015 to 2016 or so.
Yeah. Part of Oregon.
That was in southern Oregon, actually, in the Rogue River Valley. It was a old homestead down there. It's actually as a writing retreat that, you know, you can apply to, called the Marjorie Boyden Wilderness Writing Residency. If any, you know, listeners want to Google that. It's an amazing space. I mean, an incredible space. And there is a poem in here kind of based on it. It's a longer sort of sequence poem that I didn't include in this list. But, you know, it's in here. And I mean, talk about a place with bones around it. You know, it's literal bones. You know, there's like cougars, a bear, and kind of the signs of that, I don't know if I would call it violence, but, you know, the ecology kind of teeming around that space feels very present. And then there's also the violence of colonialism and kind of Western expansion and capitalism there in that land, etched in a way that is so notable, and in some ways feels maybe a little fresher than in parts of the country where, you know, that expansion happened earlier. Really beautiful, haunted, remarkable place down there in the Rogue River Valley.
We get here, again, a feeling of what it is to be homeward bound, right?
So I guess kind of following that interstate north, you know, confession in a wheat field approaching my hometown. And the epigraph, from Tess Gallagher, another Northwest writer, says, I feel at least elsewhere those able for holiness, its signs and rigors are at work. Lord, I listened for you where wind splits into song around needles of pines. In hymns my grandmother taught me, and the hunger music of gulls, but your voice was never clear. My family found you in a TV preacher's promise. My friends and I pretended we were our own movies, while the patience of scientists, men and women of unflinching faith, conspired to tell the truth, which was different than what felt true. Far one, I've carried these words through rain and the strange fine pollen of American trees, across highway towns, deaths of friends, the wide distances of a child's humming, to this field where wind keeps rewriting your name. Light comes on in a farmhouse window, and the first stars rise from the evening's bleeding edge.
Far one, not WON.
Yeah, right.
Far number one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, far one. Yes, I mean, yeah. An interesting address.
These words I've carried through rain. What is there about the far one?
Yeah, I mean, well, for me, you know, this poem kind of feels psalm-like, I guess, as well, or it feels... Mm-hmm. You know, in the sense that it begins with this address to Lord or to God or you know.
Yeah.
And I think there's kind of, you know, that God is kind of inflected along the lines of this Christian kind of background that I experienced growing up. And mm-hmm. my family finding, you know, God in a TV preacher's promise, you know. So it's kind of, I would say, a Christian God or a Lord or something that I've kind of often searched for, you know, or been really interrogative of and wanted to understand. But yeah, so far one, and, you know, it's capitalized. So it's, I'm addressing God, or I'm addressing something that I think, as the poem goes on, my sense of who I'm even addressing kind of begins to decay. And I'm generally tend to be wary whenever someone refers to a deity as Lord. You know, I just kind of, that's the Lord that I'm kind of trying to speak to in the beginning, is the Lord of my grandmother, you know, who brought me to Sunday school and taught me all these really wild Old Testament stories and stuff. And then by the end, you know, it's far one, which is something that feels far more nebulous to me. You know, a far one is the entity that feels in some ways like maybe the speaker in this book is always chasing, you know, through all of these mm-hmm. journeys out and back and homeward again and down through time, kind of chasing some essential kind of spiritual truth, I guess.
Yeah, there is the problem that you help to take us away from the sort of mythological Christian spirit of Lord with the scientists, men and women of unflinching faith conspired to tell the truth, which was different than what felt true. Yeah, so there you have made a transition, it seems, in your and then the far one becomes, like you say, nebulous.
Yeah.
But still something beyond, some sort of strange power that is still able to be perhaps observed, or at least pleaded with.
Mm-hmm.
There is a sort of pleading. I listened for you, you know. Yeah, why did I hear? Did I hear? You know.
Right. Yeah, but, I think it's true.
But you are getting into some sometimes mystical thoughts as you go through your book. And sometimes there is just a vagueness in the imagery that, for example, Riddle Oregon, I don't know if that's one that you chose, but Riddle Oregon is an interesting short poem that has some ideas in it in three couplets.
Yeah.
An unusual poem.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, I placed it right after Confession in a Wheat Field Approaching My Hometown, the one we just, looked at, because of I wanted kind of it to have, I feel like that kind of direct address to the far one or whatever name we might have for them kind of unlocks a spiritual dimension, perhaps, in this poem, or kind of casts a sidelong, maybe kind of lunar glow upon the poem. And you see this presence of something beyond, something you can't quite see. Shall I read Riddle Oregon?
Please do. Yeah, I think it says something that's quite in contrast, or sets the other one on another plane. This one here, you're getting again into the ominous.
Mm-hmm.
The mirror, the things that happen that don't always forebode, are foreboding, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Stutter steps of a stray dog range the wind-bit pines. Past scattered trailers and the nickel mine, waste pits shine like the slag of stars. A trussed-up deer dangles from a false cedar. Possums squabble for scraps of moon.
Those, the listeners, if they buy your book or if they listen carefully to that a second time, can think thoughts of maybe a very different order from appealing to a lord, a good lord. This is Sound Poetry. I've been your host, David Gilmore, with Ryla Dustin of Bellingham, Washington. RylaDustin.com is a place that you can go and find out about his new works, about him, and events that he will appear in. So hope you have a wonderful rest of the year in Bellingham with your wife and the dog that you met on a hike.
Thank you, David. Yeah, it was such a pleasure to talk with you.